Welcome to the third official episode of Does Your Favorite Song Suck, where we revisit hit songs from the 80s and 90s and try to figure out if they actually suck. I am your host, Spencer Owen, and with me today and as always...
Unfortunately, always. I'm sorry.
As always is the...
I can explain.
Is the host of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck with Travis Santel. This is Kayla Egan.
I can explain.
He's going to be my guest today.
I'm just a guest. I'm only a guest, of course, and I will not take over this show. But and I was listening back to our last episode, which, to be upfront, we recorded a million months ago.
It was August of last year.
It was
August 2017.
A year ago.
Yeah.
My God.
Yeah.
Well, and I heard myself say, or I heard you say that I would not be on that show, and then I heard myself intrude into that show a number of times, and I felt like, why can't I leave it alone? And then I thought, okay, but I know Spencer's coming to LA, and we're gonna finally get around to recording more of them because I love it so much, and you have been doing such an amazing job as a host.
Wow.
And then I'm gonna stay true to my word, and then something happened where I realized that I was going to make myself the next guest.
Which was the fact, which was when we pulled the song at the end of the episode.
But when we pulled the song, nothing happened. When we pulled the song, I was like, I don't know what this is. Like, forget about it. But so I haven't told you any of this. But the reason I am sitting across from you now is what happened as I was editing the Prince When Doves Cry episode.
Okay.
So would you like to hear that story?
I'm on tenterhooks.
I feel like I really do feel bad because like I do not mean to inflict myself on this.
But the people who listen to this podcast feed, they can't get enough Kalen.
Oh, they can get enough. They've had plenty, and now I'm double dosing their eardrums for no reason. I feel like Lenny from Of Mice and Men. I love it so much, and I'm gonna pet it until it dies. Only me, until somebody shoots me in the back of the head.
That reminds
that somebody is you, Spencer.
Now, is that the reference that they're making? No.
In Tommy Boy?
In Looney Tunes, where it's the...
Oh,
what
yes.
is the reference?
George, yeah. George.
Is that it?
Oh, for sure.
Okay.
For sure.
That's how I know that reference.
It's a dark reference. I've always thought that's a dark Looney Tunes reference.
I'm vaguely impressed with myself for picking up on... Even though it's not... You didn't directly quote it at all from the Looney Tunes, that is. But I vaguely picked up on it, and I feel... a little bit impressed that I made that connection without...
I'm more impressed than if you had just said, oh, yes, the great novel by John
Steinbeck. Without knowledge of the source material.
So here is what happened. So I was listening to the episode. I got to the end of the episode because I didn't remember from almost a year ago what was the next song. In fact, you and I had been sort of texting about it. Like, what is that
song? Yeah, what the hell was it?
So I listened and I was like, okay, I still don't know what this is. It's Roseanne Cash, 7 Year Ache, whatever. And so then I thought, well... free from the responsibility of being a host or a guest, I'm going to listen and see what that song sounds like. And I'm going to kind of cheat the system. So I put it on YouTube, sitting right here in this chair, in fact.
Okay.
And only a few days ago. And I had that moment from Ratatouille where the critic is sitting there and he eats the Ratatouille and is suddenly slammed into his childhood. And so...
incredible.
And so I started listening to that, and within 3 seconds of the song, I was like, boom, like I was sitting on my wooden floor in Alameda on Sunday afternoon, because all nostalgia happens on Sunday afternoons.
Of course.
As anyone who has seen The Tree of Life can tell you, it's all Sunday afternoon. And this fucking record was playing, and it was a record my parents had that they played all the time that I had not thought of in 30 years. And so it was this overwhelming emotional feeling. Just from hearing the first opening notes of that, I knew almost every word of it in a weird way. Like, I remembered other songs then when I looked at the album that were from that record. Like, this is the title track off of her record, 7 Year Ache. And so I thought, at the very least, you know, it's possible that Sean or Chris, who are the next guests that we're going to have in the next couple of weeks, would have known that song or had a similar experience. But it seemed unlikely to me. And so I thought, well, I could raise this. And this sort of nostalgic transportive power of music is, I found in this instance, which has never happened to me before, very unlike the nostalgia I feel for movies. It's just totally different. Totally, totally different. Whole body, whole memory, whole sensory, you know, transport. It was so fucking crazy.
Which, and I feel like that, so I am obsessed on the minor level as a fan of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck with the randomness.
Yeah.
I know, and I know that you go off course with that, and that's 100% completely fine. No problem with that, by the way, just speaking as a fan. But with the randomness of all of the episodes that came up before the last couple where you kind of threw things off, I had just been following it and wondering, like, it feels like it's like the way I like to be stimulated intellectually is, like, at least in terms of memory or nostalgia, is accessing things by surprise.
Yeah.
Like just having it come up out of totally. Nowhere. There's no more stimulating way to remember something than just have it be thrown at you like that.
I've never, and I really mean it, like with every movie we've watched, even ones that I had some very vague recollection of, it was not, and even like I've said this, I think I said this on the very first episode we did of Does Your Favorite Movie Suck when we were watching Roger Rabbit, is I've seen that many, many, many times over the years.
Yeah.
And every time I watch it, I can sort of remind and remember myself watching it at different ages. So
right.
there's some element of that I've experienced. This, I'm telling you, it was totally unlike that because I've had no, like I was sort of very moved by it largely because I've wondered this exact thing with my son who's now almost 3.
Mm.
And I joked at one point with last week's guest Fletcher about when he was like 0, we would play the song Age of Consent by New Order would always put him to sleep. Like mm-hmm. you could always rely on it. If he was screaming, having a screaming, crying fit, that song would put him to sleep. And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be a funny experiment and a mean one and born only of my own curiosity to just stop playing that for him at like the age of 3 so that, and then see what happens when I play for him when he's 25, like just like, let's just see. And unknowing that was going to happen to me. And it's like fucking crazy profound. That's a sort of derail, but I really want to ask you
yeah.
If that experience is familiar to you, or if, even if it isn't, how would you define, and it's a good way of sort of in the early going of this show, I think, to help set it up, how would you define nostalgia in music and sort of how it functions and why music and the sound of it can be so powerful?
So I have a great example of this because I was just out in Balboa Island with my parents and my wife. We went out there to drive a little cocktail boat around in the canals because it was my mom's birthday, and that was just what she wanted to do.
Yeah.
But Balboa Island has a history with my family. My dad was, he lived there for a long time, like decades. And, you know, he was living there when they started dating. and so we went there a lot, and for his 50th birthday, which was 15 years ago, more than 15 years ago, mm-hmm. we went and sat on a, you know, rented a little house on a canal over there on a beautiful August week. And we took a whole week. And I was like, it was one of the only true vacations I've ever been on in the definition of like not doing anything,
right.
Like just enjoying the place and not having anything to do. This was long before smartphones. I didn't have a computer with me. It was just different. It was just different than what we experience now. And I remember sitting on that patio on a beautiful, perfect weather day, right next to a canal where like boats were going by and kids were swimming in the water and stuff. I was by myself in a deck chair, listening to the album Sam Prekop by Sam Prekop, who is the front man of the band The Sea and Cake. His 1999 solo album was produced by Jim O'Rourke, and it's one of my favorite records. But if it weren't already one of my favorite records, this was absolutely solidified by this experience because it is like the ultimate soothing piece of music that is also like stimulating to listen to. Uh-huh. So I was in my, you know, here I'm in my teens, just relaxing. No one else is there. And the best part is that the music was not playing in my headphones. It was playing through a stereo system through the windows of the house. Mm-hmm. And I can still access that exact feeling just by putting on that album.
Wow.
I can still access it. And I remember it was like the closest thing to uncomplicated, unthinking bliss that like I've had.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
And so do you use that piece of music to put yourself back in that place specifically, or?
I've done that. Yeah.
Wow.
I've done that. I haven't done it every time I've listened to it. Certainly, I've listened to it in a lot, and a bunch of those times were just because it was like would be good background music, or
yeah.
because like oh, I really want to hear this one track. It's in my head. Or whatever. But I have definitely used it for that. I guess that gets some part of the way towards what you're talking about, which it does, a big time,
because what you're describing is an entire environment of feeling, sensory feeling, and in both cases, calm. You know, it reminds me that people, did you turn me on to this? That there are people out there who are remixing certain songs to sound like they're playing in an empty mall.
I did not turn you on to that, but I have heard of this phenomenon.
It's pretty crazy. I mean, people are really serious about it.
And I
don't know that it's quite this literal for them, but I guess what I'm getting at is the idea that it never, I'm naive about music in lots of ways.
Mm.
And it never quite occurred to me the way that music could contain and pack so much more sensory emotion or sensory feeling, sensory emotion. I don't know if that's a thing.
Yeah.
Inside itself, and it's tied to place. It's tied to time. It's time to experience an environment, and maybe that's because it's only one stimulation, and that sort of allows it to collect all these other things. Whereas for me, film is overwhelming in its world.
I'm always someone who gets mad when music isn't given the proper attention either by the filmmakers or credit by the audience in its role in films because of the power that it has to evoke things but more importantly to glue itself to other things like other evocations, other visions, feelings, whatever. I think that it has the ultimate power for that. Film, of course, is the ultimate everything art, everything at once. But I think that, and I've always thought that like that, but music being such a huge part of that, like because it's audio, not only audio, it's composed audio, it's atmospheric audio, it's like and it has this mathematical, melodic, you know, like rhythmic, all of these elements, like it's in its one sense, it's way more deep and dimensional than a lot of people give it credit for.
Yeah, yeah. Well, by itself, it is. I mean, I guess what is the obvious thing here is that, you know, a movie conjures nostalgia for itself. So when I feel nostalgic for a film, I watch that film and I'm back in the world that I felt total nostalgia for. Whereas what was so powerful to me about this and what you're describing is it's one element that manages to contain the moment in your life in an actual real human life, which was, you know, is ours. And so anyway, it was just very and the other thing about it is like it was also the and I know you'll be able to talk about this and I'm very excited, and after we hear it we'll do that next, but okay. this will be a factor is like the way that this song sounds is, and because I am sure it was played on a turntable and came out of a certain kind of speakers
in your memory.
Well, I mean, in my memory, but also factually, it came out. Yeah, I mean, I guess it's 1981.
Yeah, right.
And I was born in 83. And I'm sure my parents were still listening to this by 85 or whatever when I was,
of course,
gathering memories.
They must have.
But I know that that would have been a you know, hi-fi system, you know, a turntable hi-fi system.
Mm-hmm.
And the way the sounds that are on the track seem to me to... So. All to say, it was all environmental. It was the way that it sounds like that to me.
Yeah.
And I wonder if that's designed for I don't know how this music was coming out at the time. If it sounds more LPE or something, like I'm just like you'll see. I'm getting ahead of myself because I need you to hear it to know what I'm talking about.
I mean, I feel like I'm definitely more excited to hear it now than I have been to hear a song in a while. I wonder
if it will put you on my living room floor. Like, well, wouldn't that be crazy?
And I don't.
If my nostalgia bled into your brain.
It does the Peter O'Toole thing for everybody.
It's only my life.
Yeah, that's right. You are Peter O'Toole in this Peter O'Toole effect. I think that I just can't wait. I mean, I'm sort of immune to hype in these types of situations. No one can tell me like, oh, you got to hear this song, and then like that doesn't change
the funny thing is, and let me be very clear. I'm sure you know this already, but I'm not even arguing it's a great song.
I've actually noticed that. Yeah. I noticed that you didn't give a qualitative opinion either way.
Not at all. But I'm blind to it because of the power that this had on me. So
Roseanne Cash.
Roseanne. So what do we know about
her? I don't know anything about her.
I mean, she is the daughter of Johnny Cash.
Yes, that's what I know about her. I know that she's Johnny Cash's daughter. That's all I know. I know that recently she got in the news because Johnny Cash's music was being used by some kind of Republican campaign. Maybe it was Trump's pre-rally music or something. I don't remember.
Oh.
And I don't remember where it was used, but Cash definitely just stepped out and was like, hey, don't use our music for bigotry. You can't do this.
Well, she's stayed. This is a transition into something I think you wanted to talk about. She's stayed relatively present and relevant, unlike our first song artist, Shania Twain.
Yeah, I didn't think I was going to have a transition, so I really appreciate that. Full disclosure, I already informed Kaylin that I had some things to say about Shania Twain.
Let's do it now in the first half of this.
I was formulating a transition in the back of my mind that was going to sound something like, well, okay, I'm sure I would be happy to listen to 7 Year Ache by Roseanne Cash, but there's just something that I have to do first, which is talk about.
And now you've done it.
Shania Twain.
Transitioned exactly that way.
So, you know, again, we recorded these episodes in August of 2017. And so when it came out on the feed a couple weeks ago, I listened to our episode where we talked about From This Moment On by Shania Twain. I love putting the on. I love giving the heavy emphasis on the on.
Part of it.
So we talked about that, and something Matt said, I think it must have been, I mean, he did say it, but it must have been this that stuck in my mind that made me do this, is he said something like, you know, there's this song, like, in the context of Shania Twain's, like, whole body of work or discography, like, there might be a different way to interpret it. Like, you know, we're analyzing it one way or another, but we don't really know her work. And someone who's like a Shania head, I think you might've said Shania head, would like definitely think, you know, you guys are getting it all wrong or
Twain
something.
Twain brain. That's what I call them. Twain brains.
Did you say that on the show?
No, okay. I said it right now.
Thank God. Thank God you didn't say it then. And thank God you said it now. So that stuck in the back of my brain. And I was like, you know, I think we also overlooked that Come On Over, the album that it's from, sold 40 million copies and makes her the top-selling female solo artist of all time. And, like, that album is the best-selling country album ever. That album is the best-selling album of the 90s or one of the best-selling albums of the 90s. So it was just, like, all of that stuff that we went over and Matt's comment and everything coalesced in my brain, and I was like, I'm going to listen to this album. So I was walking to work and I put on Come On Over by Shania Twain. And I had a great time. I like it. I think it's a good album. From This Moment On is by far the worst song on the album. Wow. By far. I shouldn't say it's by far the worst in terms of like every other song is way better.
But now you can say that. You can honestly say that.
I can say that the best song on the album is great. Wow. And the worst song is that one.
Wow.
So.
Wow.
Yeah.
The best song. What is the best song?
The best song on the album. So I've been listening to this week.
Oh, more than once.
Yeah. I've been listening to it more than once. I've been getting into Shania Twain this week.
Is there more than just this album?
For me, there is more. And here's why.
Oh my God.
Here's why. Because I was looking into this, another thing we overlooked, like I was listening back and nothing, I don't think I embarrassed myself living greatest living artist Michael Jackson style in the episode, but I did say something like, well, you know, there's this guy Mutt Lange who co-wrote the song and produced the album, and he, you know, he's like a metal rock producer. He did Nickelback. I think that was my one example. Yeah, he did Nickelback. Yeah, yeah. So that's foolish because I looked at his discography and like he's been producing records for 40 years. He made the AC/DC records, wow. Highway to Hell, I think also Back in Black, but he definitely made Highway to Hell.
Oh, wow.
He did Def Leppard's hit records, Hysteria being this insane thing that I also listened to this week. It's a 60-minute album that only fit on one LP. It was like the one of the longest albums to ever put on one LP, and I think the reason is they just got obsessed with this, making this album like in a particular way.
Oh my God,
it's this weird digital heavy rock masterpiece to some, I'm sure. I thought it was fun. It reminded me of Andrew WK ways.
Wow.
So it's pretty neat. But I just got interested
in
this.
Was any of this born of a sense of guilt that we had not done right?
I don't know if I would not say that the feeling was guilt, but I would say that the feeling was, here's an album I've never listened to.
Yeah.
And what if we're wrong? What if there's something on it?
And there was. Wow.
And there was. So yeah. So Mutt Lange is an interesting guy and a huge superstar. And he married Shania Twain in 1993, I think.
Oh, my God.
And he actually married her while they were working on songs together. So, like, they were starting to make songs. Shania Twain was just, like, this working country music person from singer, you know, troubadour from Canada. Hmm. And he is, by the way, from South Africa, which is also interesting.
Wow.
And so they got married while working on songs for her second album. Her first album was not that successful. It was successful enough to make her career like promising, but
which he did not produce.
He had nothing to do with it. She didn't co-write any of the songs or anything like that. So they started working together, and the album they made together for her second album was called The Woman in Me, and it went diamond, which is over 10 million copies.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I listened to that too, and that album is pretty much, I don't want to get into much of the details of any of these songs because we may end up covering them on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much like with a couple of pop, like, you know, super poppy, like power pop songs that on it. They co-wrote every song together, by the way.
Wow.
And it's for the most part like a kind of Grand Ole Opry style, like polished country record.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like with a couple of pop crossovers. Come On Over, by contrast, seemed to clearly be like an attempt at a pop or rock, even country, like pop rock, which was a signifier in the 90s that isn't anymore, really. But like a pop rock / country crossover album. And like there's even a song on it called Rock This Country where where she's like, we're gonna rock. And there's like guitar, guitar, guitar. And then she goes, this country, fiddle, fiddle, fiddle.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So like, it's like that, that's what they're doing, right?
I love it.
It couldn't be more transparent.
Yeah.
But this is the album that, you know, it's so much fun. I think it's got a bunch of great songs, really fun songs. It's like out of the first six songs in the album, From This Moment On is at track 5. And by the way, I have things to say about that song that just, we need to wrap up.
Yeah.
And it's like the only bad song in the first like half of the record.
Well, you said, well, wait a minute, because we've done that song. I mean, it sounds like a recommendation, like go listen maybe to the Shania Twain record, give it its due. But you told me a fact about From This Moment On that I forgot until just this second that you should say.
I'll say it now. Yeah. I'll say it now, which is, when it came on, it was not the version that we heard, that we listened to twice to analyze, that we pulled off of YouTube that had 117 million views. The album version starts with a long intro where she's just intoning vows. And so the fact that I missed the wedding thing and you guys picked up on it, that was more prescient than you guys even realized, because it couldn't be more
It
obvious.
Actually contains vows.
It contains vows.
Wow.
The first minute.
Wow.
So it contains vows. And then subsequent to that, on this album version, it's a country duet. So the production is different, and there's a dude singing with her.
Insane.
Yeah, like trading off lyrics with her. And so the version that ended up on the video is like a 4-minute pop version. And by the way, I talked about those Latin guitar flourishes. Yeah. And the example I didn't say out loud that I was thinking of was "Have You Ever Really Loved a Woman" by Bryan Adams,
of course,
produced by Mutt Lange.
Oh.
So anyway.
Amazing.
And co-written by
Amazing.
Him as well.
Well, can I ask you, did you just, now we're back into From This Moment On.
Yeah.
Do you think that when it came time for that to be a single, which I think we said was one of the last singles to be released from that album.
Yeah.
They thought, nobody wants to hear a duet. Therefore, they re-recorded this or took out that vocals or whatever.
I have so much to tell you about this. Not about this exact decision, uh-huh. but about the psychology and business and whatever practices, creative practices that probably led to that.
Wow.
So when that album was skyrocketing to unheard of levels of fame, like mm-hmm. truly unheard of levels of fame, there was something going on where it was, you know, it had already been designed to be a rock country crossover album, and it sounds like one, but it is a little, it's still country, like it's still very obviously a country record.
Mm-hmm.
But apparently what was happening is that she was exploding not only in America, but across the earth. So, oh, and by the way, this is where I should insert the fact that they actually, so there's 16 songs on this album.
Yeah.
They released 12 singles from
oh
it.
Oh my God.
12 of the 16 songs were released as singles. So as they were, you know, dealing with the continuing insane success of this album, they did something that I don't know, I can't think of any other examples of this. They remixed the whole thing to have less country elements.
Wow.
And released it as Come On Over International version.
Wow.
So there are two versions of the album that I have now also listened to, both of them. The international version is worse. It's like a full star less good.
Wow.
Out of five, I guess. I would say that the order of it makes no sense. It was clearly done to like You're Still the One, which is a great song, goes first on the album instead of like in the middle. That's a terrible way to start an album.
Yeah.
And so this is like a thing that they clearly thought would be a good idea. Is like, we need to answer, we need to fill a market. Speaking of filling a market, we were thinking small about like the weddings, you know, which is they were also thinking that. But in terms of like, we were thinking small in terms of how many ideas they had, because not only did they co-write all these songs together, but Lange as a producer just had, and you know, as a business guy and like the label, all collaborated, and they were like, this just needs to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And and it's so transparent the way that they did it.
Wow.
To the point, and it must have been successful, because her next album from 2002 is called Up, and it also went diamond. It was released with this strategy. In America, you could buy it with two discs. Both of them had the same songs on them. One disc was the pop disc. The other disc was the country disc.
Wow.
And there is a third disc, which I haven't heard yet because it's apparently not going to be, or not like that easy to find. Like it's not on streaming services in America or anything, called the international disc, which from everything I've read is a Bollywood version of the album.
What?
Yes. All 19 songs.
All released in the same package?
Basically, yes, because like, so this is like early 2000s, so downloads were happening and possible. So this was very cutting edge, essentially.
This
like,
is crazy.
Like, this is super cutting edge. Like, you know, Kid A had just been streamed on the internet 2 years prior to this. Shania Twain, meanwhile, is releasing three versions of her album at the same time, and any buyer can get all three, but two of them are on discs, depending on where you purchase them.
Right.
And then you get a link to download the third one, wherever you are, whatever the third one is.
What?
And I listened to the first two versions of the album, and it's definitely not as good an album by any stretch. There's a bunch of clunkers on it. It's 19 songs.
Wow.
But there's like five songs I really like on it, and I like the country versions the best of all out of all of them. Because the rock version that they kind of do, it's like the difference in country versus rock for Mutt Lange, who's a rock producer,
yeah.
is weird because it's like, it's kind of like, here's country, like fiddles, pedal steel guitar, and then the rock version like replaces that, and it replaces it with like a guitar through a filter that goes like meow 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 meow.
Oh my god!
So like, musically speaking, in terms of like stimulation, like of like melodies and like, you know, stuff, content, counter melodies and harmonies and stuff.
Yeah.
The country versions, no contest, are better because there's more imagination musically for all those crazy session players.
Well, given that he is a rock producer, does that come from Shania, or where, like, who's overseeing the superior country take?
I think he is, but I think that he is, but, or, you know,
it's just crazy,
but it's the woman in me is, like I mentioned, is a straight up country record.
Yeah.
So he could do it. He could produce
right.
So anyway, I think I've already gone on too long about
I'm gonna transition back to Roseanne Cash by saying, in the very 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 cursory research I did on this, one thing I noted is that she, and I think she may have been in a relationship with her producer also, as they made this record, and they decided that they wanted it to be known as Punk-try.
Oh, that's exciting.
Punk-try. An unfortunate genre that never took off.
That's a very exciting idea that is badly named.
Well, when you it'll be interesting because when you hear this, let's go do this right now. After you hear the song, I think you'll know exactly what they're talking about, and I have big questions about that.
Just got to mention, Mutt Lange and Shania Twain divorced, and then she made a follow up album that sucked.
Oh, and away she went.
15 years later.
And oh no, really? Are you kidding me? After they divorced, she didn't put out a record for 15 years.
They divorced during that time.
Oh my!
She also
got
Lyme disease. I basically was going through the tabloid version of her life on Wikipedia. I got really into it.
All right, let's see if
let's
we can
do Roseanne Cash.
Let's try
though.
It. Let's do her. I mean, let's do it. Tell me you're trying to cure a 7-year ache. See what else your old heart can take. Boys say, when is he gonna give us some room? But girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
So I was sitting on the floor of your living room.
It's true. It happened.
Yes.
It happened physically.
I was literally doing that as I listened to the song. Not the same city, not the same house. Not the same year.
Yeah. Well, how did that feel for you?
It felt nice.
Yeah.
That's the thing, though, is that, like, it's a great song. Doesn't suck.
No, it doesn't suck.
I can say that right off the bat.
I never thought it sucked.
Yeah.
I just didn't want to say anything.
No, that's good. I'm glad you didn't tip your hand in that direction. But just to talk, before we talk about the actual details of what our two listens to the song,
yeah,
what I could glean from that, I could definitely see how this song in particular would be conducive to a warm nostalgic feeling.
I thought that too. And I only thought that while listening to it now, is like, oh, this is already loaded with melancholy. Admittedly, it's about something completely alien or foreign to a 4-year-old boy.
As but, many songs are.
Yeah, but it's still like that feeling of melancholy. I mean, that sound that opens it and that sort of minor key feeling of the whole thing is definitely conducive to kind of that sort of longing that I think most people associate with nostalgia. So
most definitely.
I think you're right.
Yeah, and like warm, you mentioned the turntable thing. Everyone always says like, oh, this just, it's just so much warmer to listen to records. But like, I don't have a strong sense that that's always true by any stretch.
Right.
But, you know, we could go on about that and it would be terrible. But, but I will say that like, oozing from that like mix and the recording the way it's done is kind of like that hook. The hook to me is that, like, you know, very simple sort of guitar synthesizer blend thing.
What is it?
I don't know. I can't say for sure. It sounds like a guitar, Maybe Ebode or something.
Well, what's weird is it seems to be, if it's a guitar or just a synthesizer, it's emulating a steel guitar,
yeah.
Which then they have a steel guitar.
They have a very obvious bridge, steel guitar bridge, which is like saying country. Like, it's like, and I just have to go back again. Hilarious that we can tie this back to our every element of our opening conversation, more or less. The steel guitar does just say it. Like, if you, like, you can do a subtle hint of steel guitar and you're still thinking, like, oh, there's sort of a country feel to this song.
Yeah, yeah.
And then if you do, like, what they did, which is just, like, 15 seconds of uninterrupted, unabashed steel guitar madness, then you're just like, oh, that's lovely. And this is a country song.
Yeah. Well, what's weird, so here are my, I mean, I want to continue talking about the nostalgia thing and the melancholy thing and all of that, which this song is loaded with, but What I also want to ask you is, when they say, and I brought this up with intent, when they say punk tree, listening to that song, I don't get it, except that I can hear Pretenders and Fleetwood Mac sort of from this era. So what's up? What's up with that era?
So
and this sound.
Punk was such a fucked up idea by 1981. Like, it was so huge. Like, if, by the way, it always has been, but I, like, by 1981, like, it was on its way towards being, like, misunderstood in, on every angle, even more. And the Roseanne Cash trying to pull country or punk into this country, I hear neither.
Yeah,
basically, like, in the song, like, the only thing I can think of is that, like, when Elvis Costello started, he was on Stiff Records, and that was kind of a punk scene.
Yeah.
So, like, by the way, in 1981, Elvis Costello recorded Almost Blue, his country,
which I also was going to mention. I mean, album. Like, there's one enormous overlap in my, well, there are lots of overlaps, but the biggest of them all between my taste and Spencer's is our independent love for Elvis Costello.
I think that's true.
And I Almost Blew, I thought of, I was actually, funnily enough, I was listening to, like, Punch the Clock today, and
great album.
Suddenly, I think it's a great album too, but suddenly when I heard this, even though they don't share any surface similarities, I thought, like, this is all, there's a world where these sounds coexist. And I even thought of, when I was listening to it this time, I even thought of, like, Born in the USA. Like, there's a Springsteen was doing this too. And you would be hard pressed to call really any of these people country artists. So
you couldn't call them country, and you only could call them punk because they were doing it. Was I guess really it's like in the 90s we had alternative rock, right? So in the late 70s, early 80s was punk. You know, well, like, in terms of a mainstream definition.
The funny thing about this, and this is a, I wish in a funny way, now that I didn't think of it until right now, that I would be interested to ask my parents about this, because my mom has often said that in the 70s, while glam and punk was going on, she missed all of it. She missed every bit of it. She was in the 60s psychedelia and rock scene, and then she veered hard into country during the 70s. And so all she listened to were George Jones and Waylon Jennings and Merle Haggard, and that this record would end up in her collection makes total sense on that trajectory.
It does.
And I've heard some of that music from the 70s country stars and that sort of went that way, and the themes of this song in particular live there. But it does, it sounds, and I understand what she means when she says that silly word of trying to come back into something that is happening in a rock scene, basically, I guess.
Did she also have your mom also have, like, Linda Ronstadt records?
Yes.
Yeah, so Linda Ronstadt was covering Elvis Costello.
Yeah.
You totally. Know, like, there's totally. Just this, there was just this, like, interest in whatever the alternative rock was at the time, quote unquote punk, where they were just like, you know, whatever had attitude but also, like, you know, didn't signify country but also had a lot of literacy to it.
Right.
And a lot of melodicism to it, and a lot of, like, respect for many other styles. Like, Elvis Costello is super open, aesthetically open guy, even when he was just starting out. And so the fact that he was making a country record at the same time that this was in the top 100 songs of the year in America makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, yeah.
It sounds like an Elvis Costello song in a lot of ways.
Totally.
That warm sort of hook thing, synth guitar hook thing. I think it's guitar. I don't think it's synthesizer, yeah. But it sounds so much like a synthesizer. And has the droney roll of one. Sounds like you could like turn down the highs, get that analog feel. It really reminds me of Brian Eno from the mid 70s. Yeah. And actually, once I thought of that, like Eno Fripp kind of thing, like the whole thing sounded like that for a second. Like not the singing, because they didn't ever have that kind of influence in their work, but the band. And the way it was produced and the way it's mixed and the way that thing rides on top of it and the way like the piano is just like dun 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 dun, mm-hmm. Like, you know, you could go, a music asshole like me could just go hog wild being like, were they listening to Noi when they produced this? Like, what's going on? Listen to those stabbing pianos. It's like, you know, it's like, no, but no, it's just a world of bleeding influences and feels and sounds.
Well, it's also what I think of when I think of country, and this is coming from a music asshole in a different sense, and that I don't know what I'm fucking talking about. So I'm an asshole like that. So we can both be assholes in different ways. But
great.
I don't, when I think of country music from the 70s, 80s, whatever, that seems, even the 60s, I guess, it's synonymous with studio. It sounds like when I think of like Nashville, it's like studio work. Like there's these geniuses in the studio, these musicians who are brought in to do this incredible work in a studio setting. And when I listen to this, I hear studio, and that's not a bad thing. This is actually a very good thing in this context, but it's like everything is so beautifully mixed, and like the piano comes in these very subtle ways, and like everything just sort of floats together. What am I hearing?
You're just hearing, you're hearing expertise. You're hearing a budget, essentially.
Right.
And you're also hearing the aesthetic of the time, for rock music. Like that is what a lot of it sounded like in in 1981. Like, you know, this was a time where like so much production was going way more digital. And rock music, meanwhile, there was a lot of it that just wasn't. Mm-hmm. And this is not, you mm-hmm. know? So, like, mm-hmm. Again, we just have to go back to that warmth idea. It's like, you know, whatever technology was used to make analog rock music at that time was used, you know, or country music even, was used to make this track, and the expertise, the mixing expertise and stuff. I don't know the name Rodney Crowell, the guy who produced it and who was married to Roseanne Cash, and did write some of the songs, but not this one. She wrote this one herself. I don't know what else he worked on either. Like this is a even more ignorant than Mutt Lange thing for me. Like I don't than I am to Mutt Lange or was to Mutt Lange. I don't know. The name rings a bell. I think he has produced other records, but I don't know which. And I don't know if he worked in rock. I don't know if he worked in country. And I couldn't tell you. Which from hearing it, you know?
Yeah. No, I couldn't either. I mean, of course I couldn't. I don't know anything about music. As established, I'm an asshole. Music asshole sitting here.
Wait, I'm the asshole.
but I, you know, something you said earlier, I want to follow up on. You said that Elvis Costello, this sounds like Elvis Costello. It sounds like Elvis Costello even in this era and going forward.
Yeah.
And when I think of Elvis Costello's evolution as a album artist, you know, he starts to, around Almost Blue and going into Imperial Bedroom, he starts to consciously try to expand into the what I consider a studio sound, something that's more elaborate, something that's more orchestrated in a funny way.
Definitely.
And that always read to me, I love it, but it read to me as a sort of straining for, and often achieving, a musical maturity. But the fact that he was straining for it made it Elvis Costello to me.
Yeah.
And so in this, though, it doesn't feel like anyone's really straining for everything. It feels very relaxed. And I wonder, is that the difference between somebody who is, like, let's say, raised in this world as she must have been?
Well, I think what I'm picking up on as the distinction here is, because, again, I don't, she was obviously raised in music production and in country music production specifically. But I don't hear the strain of an Elvis Costello, because I think he was, you know, someone who was just bursting with you know, the creative impulse and had also had that like young boy energy.
That's true.
This burst out.
As beautiful as I think the song is, it does not scream ambition. I mean,
no, it doesn't. What it screams is, I can write a beautiful song that is very poignant with lyrics that you will remember because they are very evocative and well worded and fit the cadence of the song and all that stuff. And I can sing it essentially effortlessly, it sounds.
Yeah.
She just sort of tosses it off.
Can I ask a question that is, I promise to stop hitting this button, but I also feel like an asshole to ask this question. But since I'm already established
please,
let me ask. The lyrics that she sings are borderline abstract, incomprehensible to me. Like, it's very hard for me to track a narrative or a real clear idea.
That's not a country style thing, as Matt brought up in the first episode of the show, where he was talking about how when he follows country music, and I think he's right about this, you know, you're looking for the specificity in the lyrics. Like, either you're hearing a very specific story being told, or someone, say that person being Shania Twain, is very clearly stating what they think about something at you. And so, like, in this song, not happening.
Yeah.
But I hear that as an Elvis-style thing.
Yes.
Costello, that is.
Big time.
I hear that as, like, a thing where he was a poet. Is a poet. Everyone just assume that I know whether someone's alive or dead.
well, can we just say, and I mean, I don't mean to be morbid, but we've just got bad news about poor Elvis.
We got bad news about him, which I thought was sensationalized by the various headlines I saw, because like, he reveals cancer diagnosis. And then in his, you know, in his note to the press and fans, he wrote, pretty amazing how, like, you know, my doctor told me that they couldn't believe that such an aggressive cancer could be removed so quickly. so basically what he was saying is, I don't have cancer. I had something. I don't have it anymore, but I'm still recovering. And because of his oblique way of writing, very witty and oblique way of writing, everyone was like, he has cancer? What the?
Yeah.
He doesn't have cancer.
Okay, good.
As far as from what he's saying, I don't think he has. He's not saying he has cancer.
I mean,
he's
what I'm really
whatever
getting
he had
at
is gone.
Is that my November tickets are still probably valuable?
I think that you're good.
Okay, cool.
But yeah, we were talking about.
Well,
his,
I'm sorry,
his,
we were talking. So, so I messed this up. So we were talking about his lyrics. I've always thought this about Elvis Costello.
He's a poet guy.
He's a poet, but what is it? I've heard him say, and you know, in his book, he says a lot about this. Is he says that he intentionally abstracts his lyrics in order to, at least maybe this is an old guy talking about his young work, you know, so put it through that filter.
Right.
But he said that he would consciously try to avoid plainly stating the true emotion, that he would write a song with a true emotion and then he would intellectually skew it so that it was harder to find and harder to get at. And he would sort of protect himself that way. And I don't necessarily know that that's what's going on with Roseanne Cash, but when I hear the obscured way of getting at it, like there's a lot of imagery and then there's sort of familiar feelings. Like here's what I can gather from the song.
Please.
There's a guy with his head down, sort of moping at a bar, and he's sort of attracting a certain kind of attention because he seems to have a sort of melancholy. And there's the title of the song, 7 Year Ache, which suggests this is about somebody in a troubled marriage. And that the girls are attracted to him, but the guys want him to get out of there. Like, that's about as much as I can make. I've listened to it a few times.
I mean, I think you probably have it.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'm going to need someone to summarize the lyrics of every song on this show, because
that would be amazing.
I will not be able to do it. Like, I just can't follow it that way, especially if it's wordy. Like, if a song's not wordy, I should say, sometimes it will be very obvious what's going on in the song lyrically for me.
Yeah.
But if it's in any way poetic, I may not grasp it.
So this is a big question for me, and this is what I was getting at earlier, is this is where I feel naive. Is like, what is a pop song lyric supposed to do, like, in your estimation? Like, when something like this is so powerful and effective, but it doesn't live in the, like, following of the words. Like,
it doesn't for me.
Yeah,
not
so
at all.
So how does that work for you?
It works like I'm hearing someone follow a melody first and then, like, right alongside of it as a secondary function, I'm hearing what the words are. But either the words are immediately obvious to me, what, just from the delivery or mixing or whatever, what is being conveyed, or they are just the sounds of English that I know, and I can follow the sentences, but they don't stick in my head. Like, right. I don't remember a single line from the song other than the phrase 7 year ache as we talk about it right now.
Well, and you said the other thing that stuck out to you while we were listening is boys say, when is he going to give us some, girls say, God, I hope he comes back soon.
Oh, yeah.
The emphasis of God, I hope he comes back soon is memorable.
It is memorable, and I forgot about it until now. Yeah. That's just, okay. It's meaning that it's just the way my brain processes this stuff. I when I heard it, I took note of it, and I was like, oh, I think I've heard this song before somewhere.
Uh-huh.
Because that God, I hope he comes in soon, like that struck with me. But not because of the meaning.
Right.
Because of the come back soon, like
right.
It sounds muffled in my brain sometimes.
Right.
So like,
right.
Whatever.
Right,
like,
right.
You know. So like, I guess the function of lyrics for me is, and I used to think this was the function of them as a songwriter too, when I wrote a lot more music, was shapes for your mouth to make in the language that you speak, so the melody can happen that are not bad when you look at them as poetry, like
right.
that are at the very least, like when you look at them as poetry, you can say like, okay, well, this person has put some thought into the order of words instead of like just saying a cliche, or if they are singing cliche, saying it very intentionally or something. There's
right.
So like, there's this weird, I guess there's this weird tri-layer thing where like one is just words to be words. The third layer is words to be words that are good. And then the middle is what they mean on some level. Like, you know, and I've been struggling with that as a song maker and as a song listener for my whole life. And by struggling, I mean, it's been real hell. It's been horrible. I've hated every second of it.
Wow.
I've been trying to work that out.
Yeah,
I'm like,
What
do I think? What do I think about this?
Yeah.
I'm still thinking about what I think about this.
Well, this podcast is really the right vehicle for you to work that out.
Apparently so.
Among other things.
We're going to be listening to a lot of songs that have lyrics.
Yeah. You would think in the top 100 of any given year, I'm going to go ahead and say
most of them.
They all have lyrics.
You
like
think
99 out of 100 have lyrics.
If this was the 60s or early 70s, they wouldn't all have lyrics.
Wow.
There would be a lot that wouldn't have lyrics. I think that in the 80s and 90s, we start to see mostly like instrumental hits, I feel like was a long lost regular occurrence.
Wow.
Like
right.
by the 80s
and 90s.
I can
think of a few for sure. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I don't know, Chemical Brothers. Even they had like hit. Like,
I can think of a few from like the 60s, 70s. Like, I don't know any from the 80s, 90s that I can really readily throw. I mean, do we have. Is like Mannheim Steamroller at the 80s? Like,
the Mannheim Steamroller is the 80s. Not going to be in the top 100. I'm going to guess not going to be in the top 100 of any year, at least in terms of the pop charts.
Right.
Definitely in the terms of the New Age or adult contemporary charts, perhaps.
That is something I wanted to ask you about, because I don't remember exactly what number this ranked this year.
Oh, 91?
Okay.
So, is that right?
So something I don't understand, and maybe you don't either, but I don't understand, definitely don't understand about the Billboard charts, is like, I know that this hit number one on the country charts. Like, this was a huge breakout hit for her, is what they would consider this.
Got it.
And then it sort of also blipped the pop charts. How are these things related? Like, how what does it take?
So as someone who only uses Billboard charts for general fascination and not for like legitimate research into the music industry, I can only hazard a guess, an informed guess, that it is based on radio play.
Okay.
So like, you know, there's pop radio, there's country radio, there's black radio at this time, by the way,
right.
like everything's are very segregated into different stuff. They still kind of are. In fact, I don't even know what radio, like radio still has the same shape, I guess right now, but
kind
like,
does, yeah.
But it's, you know, and the segregation is similar. They just don't, I call it black radio
so
anymore.
And we're all better for it.
Thank God.
So it is not it's not a given that the, something that tops the country charts in 1981 is going to also make it to the 90s and the pop charts. Like, that's, it's not like they factor that in as pop music. That
I don't think
so. Also get play on the pop stations.
I think that's correct. We can look into this in between, you know, before our next episode.
This isn't worth talking about, Spencer?
No. What I mean is we can see if we're being right or wrong.
Spencer is furiously making a cutting his throat motion at me.
I'm making a furious, I have no idea what we're talking about motion.
Well, perhaps it's worth sort of defining just generally so that we kind of know.
Yeah, we can look at this, but I think that, and let's see if what I think is true. We'll talk about it next week. Get back onto that. But I think that ultimately it has to do with pop radio play versus. I think that this song got enough play on the pop radio, you know, stations on the playlists to
which I get hearing it. I mean, and again, I know I said this earlier, but it sounds like the second or third Pretenders record to me. Like, it would be hard for me to even distinguish. Like, if someone said, hey, want to hear this Chrissie Hynde song, like, I wouldn't know the difference. Like, I'm not that, I mean, she doesn't sound exactly the same, but there's the same quality to the production and approach that I would believe it.
I hear the Pretenders thing completely, but definitely I hear it in there. And I was thinking also that there might even be a completely wrong premise to what I was saying about the Billboard thing, because I know that there's a bunch of country songs in the top 100.
Yeah.
So there really might be some mathematical formula that combines all of the charts together and gets it into the top 100 form or shape or form.
Got it.
But I think that the fact that we don't know, plus the fact that this song straddles genres like stylistic, you know.
Well, and I was just sort of amazed. What I was really asking is that I read that it topped the country chart. It's number one, and that seems like a significant big deal. And yet, it was at 91 on the year. And so, it's a different time, I know, and maybe this has to do with kind of where a genre's prominence is at any given year or whatever. But
stay tuned.
Yeah,
we're gonna get to the bottom of this. We're gonna read some formulas.
So one of the things that you had said, or we had said in the beginning, would be interesting about the show is whether listening to something from a bygone year would tell us anything about that year. I mean, does this sort of conjure anything for you about 1981 or
just that it reminds me of the stuff we've already discussed about because I was born in 1984 and you were born in 1983, so both of us missed this year. But you know, in 1981, like, I don't know, Prince made controversy. Like, we were listening to the Daz Band that, in our Zeroth episode.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of similar era. So like I, but then again, we also had, you know, Elvis Costello. We also had the Police were doing stuff. Like, I could just start naming bands and like. So that's kind of how I associate years that I wasn't alive for. I'm just like what bands were doing stuff and what were they doing? Like, what was Talking Heads doing? What was, like, you know, what were these artists up to?
I mean, my reference points are even more sort of dumb in that, like, I hear that sound, that guitar synth sound, whatever it is, which it doesn't feel dated, but it feels specific to this time.
Yes.
I don't hear it anymore. But it also sounds like, you know, Angelo Badalamenti. Like, it sounds like Twin Peaks to me. Like, there's something that is just a little bit that sort of like a drone sound behind a pop song.
It's a strange song for a hit. I think so. Yeah, I think it's a weird hit.
What makes it weird? I'd love to know that.
It's exactly what you're just saying, that droney part being like the main hook.
Yeah.
Of the song is like an unusually mixed thing for something to jump out at listeners in general. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I think that every year has had its, like, what the hell is this? Why is this on the pop charts kind of stuff? But I think that, like, you know, you can find a lot of really brainy, deep obsessives of the last 50 years of music history, 60, whatever, years of it, of recorded music, who would say that like 77 to 82 was like the most perfect boundary breaking time period for like just like well-known pop or rock music.
Wow.
Because of all of the innovations that were going on leading, you know, in record production and music technology. But at the same time, there was just this crazy explosion of people being unafraid to create a certain attitude.
Wow.
With their music.
That's really interesting to me. Is that something that you have some agreement with, or like?
I mean, if someone said that to me, I'd be like, yeah, a bunch of great music came out during that time. Like, you know, like,
well, what
Talking Heads 77 and My Aim Is True came out like the same time. Like people to television, you know, came out like this. So they use that like time period as like Patti Smith, like as like the beginning of some thing. Brian Eno was working. There's just like so many, and then the next 5 years, like all those people were doing their best work.
Right. Well, what's interesting to me about that, and knowing what I do about like the arc of Elvis Costello, for instance, is that the announcement and then the very, very quick desire to shatter the traditions of even that, you know, new sound.
Yeah.
And then to sort of recombine these high, like maybe everything is shattering right around this time in a good way, in an experimental, exciting way, so that something like this, now I'm just like reaching perhaps, but like can come back together and use various elements of a bunch of different sounds that are happening, build on the sort of traditions of studio songwriting and production, and create something that's just a little more off kilter than you would probably.
Oh, that makes perfect sense to me.
I like that a lot.
That thing you actually just said allows me to get to something that I'd forgotten I wanted to mention, which is when you listen to this song, you can, and this is true of a lot of different songs from, I think, this time period, you can hear it and you can imagine it with a different arrangement. You can imagine the melody and chords and even the singer doing what's done here, but in a different arrangement, a different aesthetic style. You can completely take out that pedal steel solo, as nice as it is, because it always is, and it, you wouldn't even think country for a second.
Right.
You can remove the drums. You can put a different beat on. You could remove the piano. You could put some more like laconic piano stuff on. Mm. You could slow it down. You could do it a little faster if you wanted. Mm-hmm. Like, there's so many different things you could do to this song as just a basic composition. And what was done to it is just of the moment. And, like, not only of the moment, but of the influence of the moment. Like, mm-hmm. you know, it could sound a few different ways even in 1981.
Right.
But because they were making punk-try, it sounds like this.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that that particular aesthetic is so specific to that time period, the one that ties this song to Brian Eno and Elvis Costello, that's what kind of defines that 5 year period for me, is that like it's so the signifiers are so specifically artistically, you know, intentional, and not meant to evoke like a genre that you're familiar with, just meant to evoke the idea of an intentional song.
Yeah.
Like Another Green World is an album that I've done a lot of thinking about by Brian Eno, and even decided to cover the whole thing at one point. And it was all because when I hear that, and that goes a little back before 77, that's 75, but it has that same thing to me of like, what you're hearing right now is not someone who's trying to make an arrangement because it fulfills a certain stylistic desire. They're trying to make an arrangement just because they want to see what happens when certain intentional elements are combined.
That's so awesome.
And I think that's what was like most at play in the best and most creative work of that time period.
You saying that has lit me on fire in terms of how many different versions of this song could exist. I mean, I think this is a gorgeous song and a really cool version of itself, of course, but I now am sort of like thinking about what would happen if you did all those things to this song, and they're all interesting takes and all very, very valid. Is that, Is there something about the bones of a good pop song that will allow that, or is it just a particular kind of songwriting?
I've actually always made fun of, in fact, the idea that, if you just strip a song down to like it's, you know, like a guitar and a singer, then you know it's good. Like, that is couldn't be farther from true to me. Like, sometimes, like, you know a song sucks until one backing vocal is recorded, and then you're like, that's great.
Yeah.
This is a great song. You know, that's the thing that makes it good instead of not so good.
Yeah.
But I also think that, like, just in terms of, like, what a basic song has going for it, like, it just depends on the ear. It just depends on the ear of the person making it, depends on the producer, depends on the listener. You'll notice that when I was describing all of those things that could be done to Seven Year Ache, the one thing I didn't say is you could turn it into a country song. Turn it into a country song. I just don't think of it that way.
Right. No,
I just don't think of music like that. Not where my brain goes a lot of the time. But it's definitely like if you take that pedal steel and stretch it over the whole thing and add a swing to the beat, you're done. Country. Instantly.
I'd love to hear this as a death metal song. Spencer, can you imagine?
Can you imagine? What if we take the time signature, add like 5 beats, so it's like a 9/8 version?
And yet, to bring it
double
even more
drum.
Full circle than we had already, that's exactly what Shania and Mutt were doing to their own music.
They were bending it
and contorting it and reshaping its production in order to try to appeal to...
It was a fascinating run.
How funny.
Shania and Mutt had a fascinating run as a collaborative duo.
Not being a fan, you've really made me miss them.
I am...
as a team.
I currently feel nostalgic for that team, even though I only just started listening to their albums 3 days ago.
Well, sorry, Roseanne Cash. You could not displace Shania in Spencer's mind.
But I'm going to listen to the album Seven Year Itch.
Yeah.
At some point. That's the thing. The phrase... Seven Year Ache is good, actually, because I did just say Seven Year Itch without thinking, and I'm sure that that's been done 8,000 million times by the people. Like, I'm sure that's been done on the radio. Like, I'm sure somebody went like, that was Roseanne Cash with Seven Year Itch, and then, like, didn't correct themselves.
Oh, they didn't correct themselves.
Probably not.
Well, I loved that conversation.
I enjoyed it, too.
I'm setting up the wheel.
Oh, right.
Did you know it's a wheel?
We didn't do that ahead of time.
Yeah, but I got it right here. I'm ready to go. Do you want to push the randomizer button, or do you want me to push it? I got it right here.
I want you to push the button, and then I will do what I can.
Oh, and then you have to rapidly look it up.
Look up the song.
Frantically look it up. All right, well, this is good. This puts us in a new era. This puts us 10 years later in 1991. The number is 1128, so that is the 28th. Most popular song of 1991.
The 28th most popular song of 1991. Okay, so I have the list. That was fast. I should have all these bookmarked, by the way. 28, you say?
I do.
This song is by Amy Grant.
Oh, my God.
This song is called Every Heartbeat by Amy Grant.
All right. Well, I know nothing.
I also know nothing. I know that Amy Grant was a Christian artist.
Yeah.
That crossed over into secular music.
Yeah.
And I know from my wife that was a big deal.
I know from my wife that was a big deal. She's a crazy Amy Grant person. Like,
yeah.
She would, I bet she knows this. In fact, she's in the house right now. Maybe I'll ask her.
We'll probably ask her at some point. So yeah, let's listen to Not Baby Baby. That's the one I know. Let's listen to next week on Does Your Favorite Song Suck? We're going to talk about Every Heartbeat by Amy Grant.
And I won't be here.